time to feel the rush of the round table live on the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
I love technology. It never happens that we can have conversations behind the scenes. Today we actually had a little bit of one, which is refreshing and nice. Refreshing and nice is what I'm saying. It's Ryan Doyle, Tamara Cherry with you here on The Rush this afternoon. We welcome in the esteemed roundtable, Marika Walsh, political reporter with the Globe and Mail. Nice to have you.
Hi, guys. I enjoyed our pre-show news meeting just now.
There you go. Just kind of going through things. We haven't had a chance to do that in a very long time. Jaskaran Sandhu is here, senior consultant at Crestview Strategy. Nice to have you, sir.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be on.
Earlier in the show, actually about the last 20 minutes, we were talking about the idea of sending your kids to Catholic school. I said as a Catholic, it was a tough decision, but we've opted not to send my daughter to Catholic school, at least in the coming year, because, well, there's a lot of clouds. There's a lot of stuff going on, obviously, not the least of which is former residential schools and the grave sites that have been found and discovered. Of course, it started in BC with 215 children being found in a mass grave. I mentioned, Marika, the idea of the child sex abuse scandal. It's one of those things that I'm not going to fault parents who choose to send their kids to a particular school. But when it comes to taxpayers and the funding involved in it all, I would hang some criteria on that funding. And two of those points would be you address in class and you teach your role in the residential school tragedy. And you talk about the cover up and abuse that happened in the Catholic Church. I think that's where you start when we talk about the money involved.
Yeah, I think part of the challenge in Ontario is that changing the funding is tied to the changing the constitution, which is not an easy road to walk in Canada, but certainly you've got to think that there are some other changes the government could do, as you suggest. And I think that there are more and more questions about this as more and more of this comes out. And also, as we see things like the priest who I believe was relieved of his duties, but said, you know, there was good intentions behind the residential schools. And I just think that, you know, that just does not hold anymore from what we have. And I think that it's not just about what you're learning in Catholic school, it's what you're learning in every school about residential schools. And I think that could be bolstered really across the board.
So there's so much I want to dissect there, but Marika, I want you to expand on the first point you made, because I think it's a really great one about having to change the constitution. I don't think a lot of people understand that. It's very easy for us to say, no, you know, we're done with Catholic school funding or everyone pull their kids out. But talk to us a little bit about that and how we are so tied into this system.
Well, that's the point, right? The Constitution actually ensures that that there are publicly funded Catholic schools in Ontario, and it's different between the provinces. It's based on sort of what structure was in place when the Constitution was struck. And so changing that requires not just Ontario's say-so, which I think would also be difficult to do, but also the say-so of potentially other provinces and members of the House of Commons. So it's an incredibly complicated process if you were to go down that route.
And then to your other point, Marika, Jaskaran, if you want to pick up on this, given your consulting role, the point being that there's not really a lot of consistent messaging when it comes to different, you know, Catholic organizations, whether it's that priest in Mississauga who is talking about the good things that happened, or if it's one rogue teacher, you know, either teaching this side or that side. Jaskaran, what do you think when you hear about all the different messaging that comes out in this? Like, is it just me, or does it seem to be lacking a united voice when we talk about all these atrocities of the past?
I think the Catholic Church is still trying to figure out what their place in all of this is, right? Well, we know what their place in all of this is, but I think they're trying to figure out what the response to that is. And, you know, for a institution that is pretty centralized and ran tightly, especially as it stands out amongst, you know, major world religions, pretty surprising that that's the case. They're figuring it out, and I think there's a moment of reckoning here that they weren't anticipating, and not anticipating it to come as heavy as it has, because you know, whenever this issue has popped up in the past, it didn't garner the type of response we're seeing now. It is different, and I think this is a unique moment that the church was just not ready or prepared for it. As for schools, I went to a Catholic high school. And I can say, as a matter of fact, like we never really talked about this. It wasn't a major aspect of our education, which is a shame, looking back in retrospect, because they played a gruesome and quite frankly, as it appears amongst many Indigenous communities, a genocidal role.
I want to turn the conversation down to the United States and, of course, the state of Florida, where rescuers and search parties are still now in their sixth day of digging through the rubble of a collapsed condo building. Evan Solomon had an exclusive interview. In fact, it was interesting to watch because the mayor of Surfside, Florida, stopped his address to the world's media, picked up his phone and called our very own Evan Solomon to talk about the latest in the search and rescue effort.
I was at the site this morning before I went up to be with the families, and the maximum effort continues. They have, you know, well over 150 search and rescue team members on the pile as it is. They've had to sort of put a cone line on the westernmost edge of the debris pile because apparently there had been the potential for debris falling or debris had fallen, and they didn't want to endanger the workers. So all the workers are focusing on the areas to the east of that. Fortunately, the area that has been cordoned off isn't very large, relatively speaking, and I know that they're working from other directions also in that area.
Marika, obviously that will continue to go on, and we hope that survivors are pulled from it. We had a bigger conversation about some of the comparisons that have been made when it comes to 9/11 and witnessing this condo collapse versus witnessing the World Trade Center collapse. Tamara and I are on different ends of that argument and different ends of that conversation. For me, I think that it's an apt comparison because it's the first thing that comes into the minds of most, but when the media runs with it, maybe they go too far in leaning on it, thus re-victimizing people who may have had an experience there.
I kind of see both sides of this. I think that came initially from that audio that was released from first responders. I think that's a gut reaction, but I do think we don't need to compare tragedies. We don't need to compare catastrophes and crimes. And so I do think that there is a risk of drawing those lines. I think they both stand as tragedies without connecting the dots between them in terms of future reporting. But of course, first responders just arriving, they're just, you know, talking. They're not giving a press conference. They're not thinking they're being recorded or published. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, I think that one of the things that the media falls into, and I was certainly guilty of this as a journalist, when we're faced with a huge story, there's not always new news to talk about every day, but we still need to find a way to cover it. So classic example this last year, the global pandemic. One of the first things I said 3 weeks into the pandemic was, I feel bad for the journalists who are having to cover the same story over and over again and trying to find a new angle on it. So I think sometimes, Jess Karen, that we can be guilty in the media of grabbing anything that is compelling or sensational without considering the news value of it, just to keep that story alive.
Yeah, and I think context here is important, right? When looking at this, I don't think in this case, you know, the firefighter or others who are comparing are necessarily saying like the background to how it happened, why it happened, the scale of the devastation is necessarily the same. It's that debris and working through the debris, which is similar. And I think understanding like firefighters and their perspective or emergency responders and their perspective when they enter a site like that, it's your brain kind of goes to quick and easy kind of comparisons, and 9/11 is obviously front and foremost in a lot of their minds. And so I think that kind of context and being considerate of that and mindful of that is important when reporting and talking about these things.
Mm-hmm. I want to make time for this story about Toronto and Toronto beaches. The city of Toronto announcing that 3 of its 11 supervised beaches are unsafe to swim due to high E. coli levels in the water. Marika, it turns out man's best friend is inputting things into the water. That's how it's described. Up to 30% of the total measured bacteria within urban receiving waters has been directly attributed to dog inputs. I just think of all of those poor people splashing around at places like Cherry Beach and Marie Curtis Park on the weekend, and well, they were splashing something, all right.
Oh, this brings me right back to my Harborfront camp days where we were told not to turtle the boats on high E. coli days. And we just ignored that rule and went in the water anyway. Oh. So I think I'm not the right person to comment on this. I am a true Toronto child, even in the hot heat of August. So yeah, I think it's just one of those challenges that any city faces. And it's, the struggle is getting the message across to the people at the water, I think.
That's so interesting, because one of the things we talked about earlier on in the show is that I never swam in Lake Ontario in Toronto when I lived there because of the stigma that was attached to the times that there is a high E. coli. So even if the city said it was safe, Jess, Karen, do you fall on the side of the fence of Marika where it doesn't bother you, or will this stick with you forever?
I was eight.
We judge you still.
When I do go to the beaches or something like that, we never go in the water.
Why?
You guys are missing out.
Yeah, no, for the same reason, because there's like stigma. It's like you don't go in the water. Like it's common understanding amongst all of us. It's like built into our DNA as we get raised. You don't even have to overtly like tell someone. It's just like you're not supposed to go in the water. And so this just confirms all that and makes me feel better about myself.
But that's not true. It's safe a lot of the time.
Well, and I will say Center Island Beach, Ward's Island Beach, they're identified as safe places to still swim.
And I would still swim there
allegedly.
Allegedly. For now.
Marika, Jaskaran, thank you so much. We appreciate it.
Take care.
Bye, guys. Thanks.